open your Bibles to Daniel chapter 6 this morning. The newsletter this morning is a big hint as to what Daniel chapter 6 entails. It's about Daniel and the lion's den. And if you grew up in church and grew up in Sunday school, no doubt you heard about Daniel and the lion's den. And in fact, if you're unfamiliar with the book of Daniel, you're probably thinking that's all that the book of Daniel is about, is Daniel and lions. It's just like a guy and his lions kind of a thing. But that's a very small part about it. And I know I've heard from many of you over these last few weeks that we've been studying the book of Daniel. I've heard from you saying there's so much good stuff in the book of Daniel. I had no idea that there was more to it than just Daniel in the lion's den. And there is. And there's actually chapters after this, by the way, that has even tons more in there as well. So stay tuned in the weeks to come for more good news from the book of Daniel. If you're new to church or if you're new to the Bible, the book of Daniel is one book that is part of many books that can make up the whole book of the Bible, the whole canon of Scripture, we call it, okay? And so the book of Daniel is one of these books, and surprise, surprise, it's about the life and words of a guy named Daniel. And Daniel, it was a young Hebrew man, a young Jewish man, who lived in Jerusalem, okay, the capital of his country, and he was part of the upper crust of society, part of the 1%. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, and God spoke through prophets to his people and said, hey, you guys are not following me anymore. You've walked away. I've warned you many times, and now I'm actually going to follow through on my many warnings, and I am going to remove you from your home country. I'm going to put you into exile, they call it, and Daniel got swept up in this. He was a young, like I said, young Hebrew man who was basically kidnapped from his hometown and now brought to Babylon, to the center of Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, to live out the next 70 years that God had promised that they'd live in exile for there in a foreign land, in a foreign country. And so Daniel, actually, as we've been discovering over these last few weeks, he is a man that loves God. And so he's paying the price for the mistakes of his neighbors and his countrymen. He's a guy that loves God, and yet he's now paying the price for them. And he's been transferred over into a foreign land. He loves God. He lives a life of devout faith and trust in God. Even though, and this is the thing that every week we're learning more and more reasons, even though he had every reason by earthly or worldly standards to be angry and bitter towards God. He was resolved in his faith, he was resolved in his strength and his trust that I will serve God even though my circumstances would give me every reason in the book to be angry and bitter and to doubt his, not only that he's good, but even doubt his existence. And you think about the life of Daniel, and we've read it over these last few weeks. Like I've already mentioned, God judged his people and sent them into exile. And not even for his own, you know, his own shortcomings, but for others. He's paying the price. God allowed Daniel to be taken from a life of comfort and privilege. Now he's over in Babylon, where he is now basically like a slave. He's a servant of the king in the king's court. And there's even very good reason to believe that a part of this new role in life that he was forced, that was forced on him by his God, he was actually castrated. I know it's a horrible thought to think about that, but think of, like, that's one of the most realistic realities. He served amongst the court of eunuchs, and most likely, at a really awkward age, he was castrated as one, and forced to serve in one of these capacities that the eunuchs would serve in the king's palace. He also had his name changed, if you remember, if you were with us in earlier weeks. His name is Daniel, which means God is my judge. But the king, through the king's officials, actually had his name changed to be named after one of the Babylonian gods. And so every day when his boss, when his coworkers, when his neighbors called him by his new name, it was like a slap to the face, a slap to his face, a slap to his God saying, where's your God now? You know, your great redeemer that rescued your people out of Egypt, you know, is recorded in the book of Exodus. Where is he now? Every time he heard that name, it's a slap to his identity, a slap to his faith, a slap to his belief. He had every reason to be bitter and angry and towards God and to reject his faith or walk away from his faith. He was forced into situations where his head would literally be on the chopping block, and yet he did not buckle. He did not cave in his faith. And because of all this, God's unique call and path and purposes for the life of Daniel to be a bright light in a very dark part of the world, he also had a target on his back. He had his colleagues always gunning for his position in the courts. He had the enemy, Satan, using his peers and using his neighbors and using his colleagues in the systems and rules of the day to try and take him out. Daniel had every reason to be bitter and angry towards God, and yet he continued and persevered in his faith. And when threats didn't work, when negative circumstances didn't have their hoped desire impact on him, he would be offered the pleasures and comforts and conveniences of the world. He was offered fame, and he was offered fortune, and he was offered power, and yet they did not interest him. They did not motivate him to leave his faith and deny his God. And so because of all of that, Daniel becomes for us today in 2019, he becomes a model, an example of what it looks like to live out a real faith in a real world. That we should expect in this life, as we follow God, we should expect both threats and lucrative offers, both designed to cause us to doubt God and derail us of our faith or our trust in God. We should expect that. It shouldn't surprise us. And as we discovered last week, and when Catherine shared in her message, we'll see again in this chapter as well that it's a lifelong call to faithfulness. And the tactics of the enemy and the pressures of the world never quit, never cease. Daniel, as we'll pick up in our text today, is an old man now. He's in his 70s, maybe even in his 80s, and yet God is still using him to be a bright light in a dark part of the world. And surprise, surprise, the enemy is still trying to take him out in his 70s or even in his 80s. And if you're in your 70s or 80s today or approaching that season of life, take heart. Also take arm. Think that your brightest days, your brightest light might be in your 70s, 80s, 90s. And because of that, the enemy still has a target on your back. And he will use the same old tactics and come from different ways to try and undermine you and your faith in what you believe about God and what he has been faithful to you in the past. And even again, we're going to read, like I said, in this chapter today, he's going to be threatened and he's going to be tempted. Now as an old man, this time by a new king. Let's pick up in Daniel chapter 6. It should be on the screen as well. It says, it pleased Darius, Darius is now the new king on the block, to set over the kingdom 120 satraps. Those are governors that would oversee a few provinces, to be throughout the whole kingdom. And over them, three high officials, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account so the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Then the high officials and the satraps sought to find ground for the complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault because he was faithful. And no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. We're going to pause here for a moment before we continue in the chapter. This has already explained what this whole chapter is about. This chapter is about the rules and the games that we as humans play. And it goes all the way back to creation, all the way back to the Garden of Eden, all the way back to where humanity chose and said, we don't like your rules, God. We think we can do it better with our own ways. We're going to take the ball that you have made, that is this life, and we're going to go to a different part of the playground, and we're going to invent our own game with our own rules, and it's going to be way more fun. That's what humanity did. And God, in response, rather than just wipe us out for being rebellious punks that we are, self-harming and other-harming punks that we are, as a result of the new game and the new rules that we invented for ourselves, he says, I'll let you play your game, and I'll let you occupy that part of my yard with your own rules for a while, but when the clock runs down, don't expect to get the prize that my game rewards you with. And for all of history, all of humanity has been reinventing the game and trying to manufacture a prize that doesn't include the way to and through God to get there. Everybody is seeking a shortcut. Everyone wants to be God and to set up rules that favor them. We want to control our lives and those around us. And just go to an elementary playground, and they're playing, you know, that game Foursquare or whatever. And you'll see, you know, from day one of school towards the end of the day, guaranteed, the playground rules for how Foursquare is played on day one of school are not the same rules at the end. They change them as they go along. And usually it's the bully, or it's the more dominant one, or the more quick-witted one that all of a sudden, I've got an idea. Let's invent a new rule to favor me and my skills and my height or my advantages or whatever. I'm getting out too much. We've got to change the rules here. I'm not getting the reward, the prizes that I think I deserve. And life really is that reality in all arenas of life. Right from the sandbox, and kids fighting over a toy and appealing to whatever higher powers they can appeal to leverage their agenda to get the toy that they want, to whine, to kick, to scream, to call mom, call dad, or whatever. Right from the sandbox to the game of Foursquare, tetherball, whatever kids play these days, all the way to Fortune 500 companies on Wall Street. It's still a sandbox. And people are changing the rules and changing the game to get an advantage towards themselves so they can get the reward that they want, that they feel that they deserve, apart from surrendering to God and doing it His way, the right way. It's human nature. It's who we are. And in the Empire of Babylon, which Daniel finds himself growing up in, you had a set of rules, a game that was being played that everyone was to live by so that society could function well. And by the way, we need rules for society to function well, to adhere to know what's expected of us and expected of our neighbor, and that if somebody goes over this line, there's going to be an infraction and all those kinds of things. We need that as a society, but any society that's built on laws and rules that aren't from the wisdom of God are going to be built on a lie, and they're obviously going to be slanted and inward focused, and they'll breed destruction and chaos. But society was playing a game, and it was playing it well. I mean, it was an empire that was huge. They had conquered so many nations, including the nation that of Israel that Daniel was a part of. And most people seemed to like the rules of Babylon, because if you worked the rules hard and you became a master of their rules and you knew the loopholes and how to leverage this law against this law and set people up in a certain way, there was opportunities in a growing kingdom, a growing playground, for you to expand, for you to improve, and you to climb up the corporate ladder. There's an opportunity for that. And so people liked that game, because there's an opportunity for them to use other people to get higher up in life and to seek more of the comforts and conveniences of this world. There's an opportunity for you to succeed and find greater fame, greater fortune, and greater power. But now all of a sudden, into this Babylonian game, and with all of their rules and values, you had this exile guy from Judah all of a sudden dropped now into your midst. And what's unique about Daniel is he comes and lives amongst the Babylonians, but he doesn't play by the same rules of the Babylonians. He doesn't play the same game that they're playing. He plays by the rules of his God. He doesn't care about the prizes that his peers have set up as gods. Temporary fame, fortune, and power do not interest him. He cares about one prize and one prize only. And it's a prize that can only be found by playing the game that God created us to play from beginning, our life's purpose, to surrender to him, to walk in faithfulness to him, that he actually, at the end of the day, is the prize, and all of the stuff that we seek in this life are just byproducts of the prize, of being with God. He cares about one prize, the eternal reward, to be reunited with God and to live in an eternal kingdom where there is nothing but peace. And this, as we'll continue to read and have read, will drive his colleagues nuts. Not so much because he doesn't play the game and doesn't follow all their rules or works for the same prizes that they work for, but mostly because he's playing by different rules and he's playing a different game, and he's also getting the temporary rewards as well. And it irritates them. It aggravates them. And because it puts into doubt their trust in their gods, in their rules, and the game in which they've constructed and given their life to. Think about that. They've poured their whole life in. They've compromised their morals. They're doing everything that the king is requiring of them. And they're going about it in a self-serving way. And here comes this guy that does it with selfless motives. And he's the one being promoted. He doesn't even care about the prizes, about the pension plan and the profit sharing and all the stuff that you get if you work hard in this game of this world. Doesn't care about it. And it puts into doubt their trust in their gods, in their game, and the prizes of their game. And with that doubt comes fear. Fear of losing the game. Fear of being wrong, that you're playing, you know, this whole time, yep, that inner witness within your heart that says you're being selfish and self-serving and ignoring the God of the universe. That yes, in fact, the game that you're playing that's trying to silence that voice is in fact the wrong game. That it's promising things that will never deliver, that only God can deliver. Fear of that this whole time you've been believing in a lie. Fear that Daniel and his God just might be right. And so they seek out of fear, they seek to silence Daniel, believing, because this is what their game and their rules say, if you can silence somebody, either by threat of death or death itself, then you'll be able to silence the witness that their game testifies to you in your life, that there is a God and that you're not him. And that all that is good and true and worthwhile in life is found in him and through him and for him. And so they seek to silence Daniel, thinking that in silencing Daniel, they can silence the voice of God himself. And so what do? They use the rules of their society, of their game, to try and defeat Daniel. But they can't. He lives a perfect game. Why? Because he lives out of faithfulness to God, and his motives are not self-serving. And so they figure out, okay, our rules now need to take on God's rules. In case you're not following all of this analogy here very well, it's like this. Say you work in a company, and you're the only Christian. And in that company's culture and values, it's accepted practice, even like, encouraged, it's accepted practice to lie to the customer in order to get more sales so that both you and the company can share in greater profits, greater sales number. And one of the motivations behind this incentive to lie and to bend your morals and all those kinds of things is at the end of every month and at the end of every year, there's a bonus commission for the top salesman of the month, the top salesman of the year. And so all the salesmen in the company, they just bust their butt, break their backs, compromise their morals to get the highest sales numbers. so that they can go on that vacation, that God that they worship, that thing that is, they think is going to bring them the good life. So they can go on that vacation, they can buy that truck, they can put the addition on their house or whatever is their prize that they've manufactured as a replacement for the satisfaction that can only truly come from a right relationship with God. They do all of this, but then you come along and you're a Christian and you're honest, not only with them, but you're also honest with the customer. And instead of losing business, your honesty actually causes your business to increase and you outperform all of the other salesmen in the company. And then to make things worse, you get the prize money at the end of month after month after month, year after year after year, you get the prize money. And you know what you do with it? You give it away. You give it to charity. You give it to the homeless person or whatever it might be. And oh, does that stab your coworkers in the heart? Not only are you not playing by their rules and compromising the way that they've compromised, but the things that they're actually breaking their backs for and compromising and selling their soul over, they don't even mean anything to you. Who cares about a truck? Who cares about a boat? Who cares about a bigger, nicer house? That's not what life is about. And so in retaliation, in revenge, they try to get you fired. And they look in the company handbook, the employee handbook, to figure out, how are we going to get this guy in trouble? And they look through the handbook and they find this guy follows every single one of our rules. In fact, he follows it better than we do. And this is our gain. This is what we trust in. This is what our hopes and our dreams and our security and our identity is built in. And he follows it better. And so they figure, okay, let's make a little change to the employee handbook. We know that this Christian goes to church every single Sunday. So let's go to the boss. Let's appeal to him, make our case. And so the boss changes the handbook. And he all of a sudden now says every employee needs to work on Sundays as well, because it's going to increase profit for himself and for the business and for the employees. And so on Monday morning, when you walk into your workplace expecting to find a pink slip on your desk because you didn't show up for work that Sunday, you see pink slips on everybody else's desk. And you walk to your boss's office and you say, "What gives? Why is everybody getting laid off?" And you find out not even one customer came through the doors that Sunday. And now the boss is out all of those people's wages for that day. That's a made-up story, but if you follow God in faith, that kind of integrity, that kind of faithful devotion, you will have stories like that time and time again, where you did what was unconventional to the world's values and the world's way of living, and yet somehow it worked out in a way that you can't even really describe. And even though you thought that it would cost you something big, quite often it doesn't, or it didn't. That's just a made-up story. I was talking to a Parksider actually after the first service today, and he said that, you know, he has an opportunity in his place of work to work on Sundays. And it's bonus pay when you work on Sundays. So you get even paid more than if you work on a different day. But him and his wife, they were thinking about that, they were praying about it, and they made a decision, you know what, no, it's not good for me to miss out on church with my family on Sundays. And so they made the decision just this week, and it's kind of funny that this sermon kind of connects with that. They made the decision this week that their family's not going to work on Sunday because it's more important for them to be here on Sunday together as a family. And so they're making that decision, and they recognize, okay, this is going to cost us. It's going to be much more difficult for us to make ends meet now as a result of missing out on that bonus pay that would come from working on a Sunday. And just so you know, when it comes to working on Sunday, I have a much more gracious view of the Sabbath and things like that than a lot of legalistic people do. But that being said, one of the wonderful things about Daniel is navigating all of these kind of real personal decisions. It's not always just this legalistic black and white thing. In fact, it's not that. It really does come down to the Spirit of God living inside of you, illuminating God's word, yes, but also then helping you apply it in a personal way. But I watch people, even many Christians, get caught up in the drama of this life, in the drama of this worldly game that our neighbors play. Whether it's politics, whether it's health diagnoses and different trends and diets and things like that, whether it's stock market volatility, whether it's real estate prices, we get caught up in the game, and we rest all of our hopes and dreams and identity and security and fears and all of that stuff in the stuff of this life, in the game that is this world that is created apart and in rebellion to God. They really aren't a big deal. I mean, we aren't stressed and we aren't anxious like others because we haven't hitched our wagon to the temporary stuff of this world. We follow God and we know that we're in His hands, and so that even if life feels like a free fall, we're still in His hands, and we know that there is a bottom, that He will catch us. And this is both our response, the way that we walk that reality out in our life, serves as both a witness and an irritation to those around us. Because we don't react like them. We don't play the game that they're playing. And we don't live the man-made, self-serving rules of their game. And it becomes very liberating for us and terrifying for them. We work hard as employees, as employers, as citizens, as moms and dads. We work hard, but we don't work hard for a paycheck. That's the rules in the game of this world. We don't work hard for advancement or promotion. We don't work hard to hear the applause and the approval of our peers or our colleagues. But rather, we work as unto the Lord. We work with all of our heart to please Him out of love for Him. And we could care less, we couldn't care less actually, about the paycheck or the promotion or the applause. Because we don't answer to the game of this world. We answer to God. And it is His desire to reward us when He wants, as He wants. And this, by the way, it won't bother our coworkers at first until, after a few days on the job, they begin to see something different in you. Because they'll see that your God outmotivates their God. When we outwork them, we begin treating what they break their backs for as insignificant compared to our eternal reward. And it becomes a battle of the gods. Our God will have to take on that person's God. All of a sudden now you have that very reality at play, because that person is living for the promotion. They are living for a new boat. They are living for a nice retirement. They have put all of their eggs into this basket that says this life is the end all and be all. And now you come along serving a God that says that's not true. What you're giving your life for, what you're breaking your back for, what you're compromising your morals for, what you're sacrificing your kids for by working 16 hours a day, 7 days a week to get that promotion, what you're killing yourself for will actually kill you. And you won't even pay off in the way that you hope it will. The things, even if you get the promotion and the cushy retirement, it will not deliver as it promises. And so you begin to outwork that fellow worker of yours, that colleague of yours, because you have a different motive, you have a more powerful motive. Your prize, your motivation, your provision for your work is so much greater than anything this world can muster up. And so you outwork your peers. And what happens quite often is they freak out, because it reveals a weakness in their God in comparison to our God. It sheds a light on the futility of the game that they have invested their entire life into. And most of the time, not always, but most of the time, even though we could care less about the promotion or the paycheck or the applause, we will be the ones that will get it. Why? Because we can be more trusted than the person who's just in it for themselves. And an employee that is in it for themselves is more likely to cut corners, stab others in the back, and cheat the boss. But an employee that fears God knows that at the end of the day, they don't answer to their boss and they're not working for a paycheck. They will be more committed and more honest than even the own owner of the company, because so much more is at stake. I recently heard of a businessman that wrote a check for $250,000 and gave it to a church in Canada. And when he came with the check in his hands to deliver it to that pastor, he said this. He says, "I don't even go to your church. But over the last year, more and more and more of my employees have been attending your church. And I don't know what you're doing over here, but it's changed the way that they work. So much so that it's added a huge amount of profit to my bottom line. And it just seems right for me to come over here and with this check, not only say thank you, but to see it as an investment, to keep on doing what you're doing because it impacts my bottom line." That happened last year in Canada. What about you? Are you caught up in the game of this world, using the rules, trying to find a way to jump through the hoops of this world to get it to work towards your advantage? Or is your one concern, how peaceful and wonderful is it that we only have one concern? Or is your one concern faithfulness to God? If you live at peace with your Maker, you will live free from being a slave to the game and the rules of this world. That's what Daniel teaches us. This is what he demonstrates for us. He's a real person in history that lived this out so well for us to follow in that example. Moving on in our text, verse 6, it says, "Then these high officials and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, 'O King Darius, live forever. All the high officials of the kingdom, the prefects and satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked.' Therefore, King Darius signed the document and injunction." Let's pause here for a moment again. And again, we hear this continuing theme of games and rules, although I'm using rules as a synonym for laws here. They're using their rules to try and win the game and get the prize. They use their rules to try and silence and remove Daniel's testimony and of the one true God. Now, why on earth do they use this tactic? Why on earth do they use these rules? Because it's the I'll try to stop doing that. Because it's the rules that they trust in. They worship their rules. It's their higher power, so to speak, that they have to appeal to get Daniel to change the way that he is living, to get him out of the picture, to get his God out of the picture. Their rules promise them the good life without having to bend a knee before God. Their rules say that if you threaten somebody with death and have the credibility or the law behind you to back it up, then they will comply. That's what their rules say of their game. Their rules say that if you feed a human into a den of hungry lions, that those lions will eat that human. Their rules say that killing or silencing a Christian will silence the witness of God in their lives. And so they come, believing in their rules, they come before King Darius, they lie to him, saying that everybody's in favor of it, and he falls for it. Verse 10 continues. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Daniel doesn't even flinch. He's lived at this point of his life through so many kings at this point that he's not going to cave. He will continue to do what he has always done, pray morning, noon, and night, even though The pressure that he was facing in this challenge, I believe, was the greatest pressure or temptation that he had ever faced in his life. We get that from the text and from the other texts in Scripture as well. One commentator makes the observation that because Daniel was so late in his life here, in years, that he was actually nearing the end of the 70 years of exile that God had told his people they would be in exile for. And so now he's an old man. He's faithfully served God all of his life living in exile. And now he's near the end of not only his own life, but he's also near the end of this period of 70 years of living in exile. And all he has to do is just stop praying for 30 days and he will live to see another day, maybe even the day that he has lived for and prayed for his entire life, looking out through his window towards Jerusalem to finally return home. All he's got to do is give up 30 days of prayer and he will, as an old man, see what he has been prayed for and working for his entire life. But if he does pray, he knows that it will result in certain death, for he will be thrown into a den of lions and be torn piece by piece. Additionally, Daniel could have also easily rationalized not praying for 30 days. He could have leveraged in his own rationalization, justification, he could have leveraged all of his previous years of service and of sacrifice and faithfulness and dedication to God. He could have sold himself the lie, I know God wants me to see my hometown. I know he wants to reward me for all of my years of hard work. What's a little compromise in light of decades of service and sacrifice? But he doesn't cave. He doesn't buy into that lie. And here, you and I might have avoided praying before a meal in our workplace or in a restaurant, to avoid a little embarrassment or awkwardness. And yet here Daniel is. He could avoid torturous death simply by not praying in his bedroom, by skipping prayer, and he doesn't. He doesn't live by the games and the rules of this world. Continues on in verse 11. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. Then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, The thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. Again, the king's relying on the laws of the land to deliver Daniel, to try and find a legal loophole, so to speak, but there are none. He labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, May your God, whom you serve, continually deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Then at daybreak, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I have done no harm. Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. I want to pause there again for a moment and remind you. Men and women throughout history have been both burned alive and torn to pieces by lions for being faithful to God. That has happened in history. obedience and faithfulness to God does not mean that he will always shut the mouths of lions. Rather, God will always do what is good, both for you and others, in terms of the eternal end game. Either by the miracle of closing the lion's mouth, or by using your martyrdom, your faithfulness, even in spite of persecution, your martyrdom as a witness that you do not fear death. Either way, the resounding testimony of a faithful Christian is that we do not fear death. God, now in this specific instance, he miraculously rescues Daniel. Why? Because it crushes the very gods that his captors worshipped. They trusted in their own rules and their own natural observations. They trusted in a game that rejected God. Rules that promised to deliver but never do. But the witness of God continues, and he gives them the prize, the fulfillment that their game and their rules afford them, that is death. Verse 24, and the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. This, by the way, answers the skeptics' questions. Maybe the lions weren't hungry. That's why they didn't eat Daniel. But more so, as you read this, it might sound extra cruel that the women and the children were also thrown in. But as Catherine actually mentioned last week, the secular historian Herodotus, he actually informs us that such punishment of the entire family was the normal measure used by the law of the Medes and the Persians. The same law that they trusted in for life, for promotion, for security, for advancement, would in fact be the same very law that would kill them, that would defeat them. I think of Jesus' words when he says in Matthew, for in the same way that you judge others, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured to you. The law and the game that they trusted in for the good life would be the same law and game that would take their life. Continuing on in verse 25, then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. That's the end of chapter 6. And all of this boils down to us today to say that the promises of kings and kingdoms, the games and rules and rulers of this world will come and go. But God's promises will remain. Prime ministers will come and go. Ministers of education will come and go. Bosses will come and go. Colleagues will come and go. Laws will come and go. Stock prices will come and go. Ideologies will come and go. Science discoveries even come and go. They discover something, they recant something. Diets will come and go. And caught up in the middle of it all are the people of God. The Daniels of the world, the church, you and me. In your workplace, in your school, in your family, and in your neighborhood, you are the one, you are the Daniel in those circumstances that gets caught in the crunch of two kingdoms. That's our role. And that's why Daniel is so important to us today in 2019, because he's a real life person that lived in the middle of that crunch and never buckled. Never wavered, even in the threat of death. Daniel reminds us that a life of faithfulness in Canada in 2019 will not be easy. People will demand that you play by the rules of their game. And if you don't, they will seek to silence you either by threat or temptation. And it's the same old tactics that the evil kingdom against heaven has used right from the Garden of Eden. It is seen in Daniel's life, and it was seen in the life of Christ. The same old tactics, the same old approach, either temptation or threats to trying to get you to compromise your faith, your integrity before God. You can expect that in your life too if you are day by day continually following the living God. But through it all and in it all, we can look to Jesus. That when we stare death in the eyes, that we can share in his death, knowing that we will also share in his resurrection. Death is no longer the master that we fear. Worldly pleasures are no longer the best this life has to offer. In Jesus, we have life after death, and in Jesus, we have an eternal home filled with eternal pleasures forevermore. The promises and the pain of this world are fleeting. The kingdom of God endures forever. That's a hope that motivates faithfulness today. Because your circumstances and your path that God has for you to live in this life will undoubtedly lead you into seasons and to circumstances by through threats or temptation will seek to silence the voice of God in your life and the voice of God through your life to others. That is the game, that is the goal of the enemy, that is the byproduct of this chaotic world that we live in that chose to live with self over God. Perhaps this morning you are dwindling in faith. Perhaps this morning you have caved on your convictions. Perhaps this morning you're living a life of comfort that is causing you to be distant from God and disengaged, in the life of faith that he has for your life. And if that's you this morning, look to Jesus. In Jesus, there is forgiveness. In Jesus, there is hope. In Jesus, there is a way forward. We read today in this chapter that Daniel, when he prayed, he would open up his bedroom windows and he would pray towards Jerusalem. It was a view, a symbol that served as an aid. There wasn't anything magical about praying towards Jerusalem, but just served as an aid in his faith and in his prayer, a tool. And it was that view towards Jerusalem that would daily remind him in his prayers of what is truly good and what is true. What is worth living for and what is worth dying for. Today, we're actually going to close our service with a different view. We're going to open the windows of our hearts and our heads here this morning, and we're going to look to a new symbol that we've been given. We don't look to Jerusalem in 2019 as our symbol of beacon of hope. We look to Jesus as our symbol and beacon of hope. On the first Sunday of every month at our church, we participate in a thing called communion. We're going to pass around in a moment a cracker and a cup. They are our new view or our new symbol in this life in 2019 that serve as an aid to remind us of what is really good and what is really true, what is worth living for and what is worth dying for. And it is a view, it is an opportunity that we have to look at those symbols and to be reminded of Christ's death and resurrection and fill us with renewed faith to both die to self and then look forward to the resurrection that will come in whatever day he has for that to come. That's in his hands. And we can trust that he is good because he went all in for us on the cross. And we can trust that he is strong enough, that he is great enough to pull it off because he rose from the dead just as he said he would. No other king, no other ruler, no other game, no other rules have been able to pull off that kind of power, that kind of love. That's why he's worth following. And I trust that as we participate in communion today, that your faith will be renewed, your faith will be built up, your faith will be restored and even strengthened to the point that you will live with integrity and faithfulness to God, not just on Sunday, but on Monday through Saturday as well.